Correa and Casagrande are waiting for a cross, and Josimar!
Well, if those clips sent tingles down your spine, chances are you're looking forward to the World Cup. Football's unique mix of beauty, controversy, skill and memories. Just 13 countries entered the first World Cup in Uruguay, but 32 will contest this summer's championship, played, of course, in Brazil, spiritual home of the beautiful game. It means we're unapologetic about devoting this edition of Toolstation's In Conversation exclusively to football.
Yes, it's our regular look at the nation's best sportsbooks, and don't forget you can win the current top 10 sportsbooks simply by visiting Toolstation's Facebook page. Also on the Facebook page, you can hear a full-length interview with our very special guest, World Cup final referee Howard Webb. Howard is now in Brazil, but we managed to grab him for an exclusive interview before he travelled to the land of samba, sugarloaf and beach volleyball. Howard's selection of his all-time favourite sports book is a surprise, and he offers a fascinating insight into the life of a high-profile, world-renowned match official. We also have Jimmy Bullard, the former painter and decorator who became a Premier League footballer. Jimmy's autobiography, Bend It Like Bullard, is described as a rip-roaring, life-enhancing, hilarious memoir from a football cult hero. With publicity like that, we couldn't fail to have him on the show, could we? But we start with Andrew Smart, author of Best Pelé and a Half-Time Bovril, a fantastic account of football in the 1970s. This was a time when Frank Elvis Worthington strutted his stuff, when the FA Cup still meant something, when half a dozen teams could be league champions, and when it didn't cost the equivalent of 2 weeks' wages to go and watch a match. I began by asking Andrew if the relative decline of English football could be traced back to Gerd Müller's goal against England in a 1970 World Cup quarter-final.
I suppose that's a fair point, actually, because that was the golden squad, if you like, thought to be even better than the 1966 squad that won the World Cup. And it was sort of where Ramsey got it wrong, because he took Bobby Charlton off when England were leading 2-0, and that freed up Franz Beckenbauer, and from there defeat loomed, and England never really recovered. I mean, throughout the 1970s, they were dire. They couldn't qualify for tournaments. They swapped managers. They had a disastrous time with Don Revie. Joe Mercer took a little caretaker job. Then Ron Greenwood came along, and not the most exciting manager. There are comments in the book by Brian Clough which allude to what he thought of Ron Greenwood.
You look through the 70s and you start in 1970 when Everton won the league title. You look at 1979 when Liverpool won it. Okay, I have a vested interest there. But there were six different teams that won the league title during the 1970s. Do you see that happening again?
Never. And that was really where the book started from. I'm a Nottingham Forest supporter, and I look back to the glory days of Forest in the late 70s when they emerged from the old second division, immediately won the first division title, then went on and won two European Cups. It is unimaginable today. There's no way that any side could do what Forest did. And also bear in mind that during that decade, as well as Everton, you had Leeds United, Derby County both winning the title. That will never happen again. Those clubs just cannot summon up the resources to challenge what has become a cartel, really, at the top of the Premier League. And it's all set up and designed to exclude everybody else, so they get all the rewards, and I'm afraid the rest of us are beggars at the banquet.
Is the same true of the World Cup? I mean, there were 13 teams that entered the 1930 version. There's 32 in Brazil, but frankly, there's probably only three who can win it.
I think that's probably true, and I think the increased number of is purely for television. They want to stretch it out as long as they can. It's all about TV audiences and therefore advertising. So I think, yes, the 90% of the teams are going there with no chance at all. And I think the same is said about football in England, that it's really set up for TV now. I mean, it's saturation coverage. It's on at any unusual time you care to name. I mean, back in the 70s, football kicked off at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon.
There's an absolutely fantastic statistic that you have in the book. By 1992, or even as late as 1992, there were only 11 players in the top flight from outside of the home nations. And frankly, only two of those, Schmeichel and Cantona, were what you would call top-class players. now we have had difficulty finding 11 Englishmen to go and play over in Brazil. Do you see that particular trend reversing at all?
I would like to think it might happen, but I can't really see it happening. For one thing, English players have become too expensive, and owners of clubs want instant success. So rather than allowing young English players to develop, they go immediately for high-blown foreign stars who can come straight in and turn their team into challengers. And what they're all chasing is a place in the top four, and that's kind of goes against the grain for me as well, because where's the glory in finishing fourth? But that's what they're trying to achieve now. Back in our day, you had to try and win the title, and you were remembered for winning. You weren't remembered for finishing fourth or getting through to the semi-final of the FA Cup. You didn't get a game at Wembley if you were a loser in the semi-final of the FA Cup, and today they do.
Who's going to win the World Cup?
Well, I suppose because it's on home ground, you have to favour Brazil. Although I don't think they're quite the power that they used to be. And I think if I was going to put my money on any side, it would be Argentina.
Best Pelé and a half-time Bovril available, and published by John Blake Publishing, is available. You've just listened to the author, Andrew Smart. Andrew, many, many thanks for taking the time to come on.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Now, here's a couple of comments from real people, each referring to a book written by our next guest.
If you liked him before, you'll love him after this. Charming, easy read from one of the game's nice guys.
And one cryptic one.
If you ever meet him, make sure there's no railjacks, fire extinguishers, or convertible cars anywhere close.
The book is Bend It Like Bullard, and it's a pleasure to welcome Jimmy Bullard to In Conversation. Jimmy, tell me, did your mum write those reviews?
Well, funny enough, mate, she's standing right here next to me if you want to ask her. it took me a long time to do the book, really. It was up to 9-10 months with me and Gersh, who helped me write the book. But, it's full of surprises and stories, mate, which I thoroughly enjoyed doing, you know. Being a football player, I suppose you're in sort of a male environment, if you want, and you're all together and boredom creeps in. You know, a lot of my antics that I got up to, boredom factor, really. And before you know it, you've got a tube of railjacks in your hand, and you're deciding what to do with it, you know, and who to spike and who to put in some pair of pants or who to put in a toothpaste or face cream. All my mates say I'm a nutcase, but I don't really think I am. It's strange.
Let's not comment on that. Now, listen, your book, Bend It Like Bullard, is subtitled The 12 Pillars of Football Wisdom. And you come out with stuff like celebrate every goal as if it's your last, confuse the opposition by having girls' hair and stuff like that. Correct. Which one of those 12 pillars would you go for? Which one's your favourite?
To be fair, we fought long and hard about a few of them, you know. Refuse wisely with your half-time cuppa unless Barry Fry has kicked it all over the floor. That was my first introduction, if you want, to first-team football. Reading it for me, some bits was quite emotional. You know what I mean? I went through some, as in, like, football terms, bad times. Not in life in general, but as in football, I went through some rough times. Do you get what I mean? It's rawer. Do you get what I mean? I haven't held back with anything. I've told it exactly how it is. There was a couple of things where I couldn't say to do with courts and stuff. But everything there, I've let two England managers have it, you know, without really knowing it. It's just what was on my mind, exactly how I felt.
I'll tell you what, one thing that does apply to you is where you've got your relationship with Barry Fry. It was almost like father and son. I mean, you played under a lot of managers, but Barry was obviously, you know, top man as far as you were concerned.
He was, I come from West Ham under Harry.
Yeah.
Who, even though Harry was brilliant for me, he wasn't really my manager there because I was in the reserve team.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden me going to Barry Fry and the manager really, really wanted me to play for his team. And he was quite a down-to-earth kind of person, as a lot of my managers are, but he was my first real manager that gave me the chance, if you know what I mean, and sort of grabbed me, and if I was going through a rough time, he'd call me, how you doing? You know, and even when Paul Jewell called, you know, he just called me up on the cell phone, Jim, come here, I've got an offer for you. You know, it was like that. There was no agency involved. He was like, if you want, a father figure and a friend. And then I had the other side, which was Rodgson, Fabio Capello. It's so strict and school teacher-esque, if you want. Yeah. I was a bit like, wow, now going from one team to that team expecting the same thing wouldn't work. It would be like, well, I was allowed to do that in the other team. That comes on here and stuff like that. So, but that's sort of how my career went.
And when you refer to, you know, Fabio Capello looking like Postman Pat, I can't look at him now.
He looks exactly like him, no?
He is Postman Pat's brother. I mean, did you ever tell him that?
It's like two kids getting together. You know, two kids having dares, you know, who can say it the loudest. It's like me and Bentley, because Bentley is another. He probably out of all the football players I met, he isn't scared to do anything. We was just having dates, you can say, Postman Pat the loudest. Just silly things. After 2 weeks in a hotel, you just start. And me telling you here on the phone sounds so ridiculous. But being involved in a moment was absolutely hilarious. And me and David would have like a dare. And he actually went straight up to Pepio and went, Postman Pat and his black and white cat. Straight to his face. And I thought, I can't top that. How can I top that?
We've been talking on the show here today about the World Cup. And can England get out of their group, do you think?
Oh, definitely. For me, I've called semis. I think we're going to get to the semis. I know it's a big call, but I really do. I really fancy the young talent we've got on board and new and hungry as well. New hungry talent. Ida Tiger, I'm a massive believer in that. But I think we're going to surprise a few nations. And I think we're going to go semis and whatever happens there.
There is a gem of football wisdom from Mr. Bullard himself there.
But what do I know? What do I know, fellas?
I didn't want to say that. Jimmy, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks,
and your mum.
Thanks for having us on. Talk Station.